Read a little earlier, Genesis and chapter 4. Over recent times that I've been taking the evening service, we've been looking through the gospel, how it should be presented. So can you just turn me down a little bit, because I'm really very loud, sorry. And we were looking particularly at what the gospel message is, so we can actually fully understand it, so we can actually declare it to others. So it would probably seem surprising to some that we have continued on past chapter 3 and entering into chapter 4. But it is quite vital and quite important for us to really understand what is shared here. Indeed, in Genesis chapter 1, we looked at the fact that God is creator. He's created the entire universe. That he created mankind in his own image. And we looked, obviously, within chapter 3, the fact that Adam and Eve had sinned. They'd fallen short of God's requirements for us, that indeed they disobeyed him. And there was a grave consequence, not only for them, but also for the whole of mankind, with regard to that disobedience. And now we come to chapters 4, and I would encourage you to read the rest of chapter 4 in your own time, and to indeed read chapter 5. The information contained in there is very helpful, very useful, very informative. But what we need to do is to really look at this passage carefully and consider what is shown. So if we look now at chapter 4, and we think of verse 1. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain. Indeed, it's important for us to realize that this isn't an account of how many children Eve had. This is not an account of exactly which children were born in which order. The aspect is that we aren't told whether Cain and Abel's sisters were born before they were or after they were. We know they had sisters. And indeed, the account here has a very specific message for us. It's not determining for us all the children that Adam and Eve had. And we see in this that Cain is the first son to be born. In many respects, we often have a tendency of thinking that all these things happen in quick succession. We had Genesis chapter 1, then Genesis chapter 2, detailing more of Genesis chapter 1, and then Genesis chapter 3, the fall of mankind. And we think of all of those being one day after another. Now, obviously, the account of creation was one day after another, but as we looked at previously, when exactly the fall of mankind actually happened, whether that was days, weeks, months, even years after that initial creation, we are not fully told. But we are informed of certain characteristics. And we know, if you look over those following verses from the passage we read, we know that these verses that we are looking at happened sometime before Adam was 130. So we have 15 verses that took place somewhere in the first 130 years of Adam and Eve's life. So that's quite a long time period. So it's really important that we understand that that is the case. And we find here that Eve seems to initially acknowledge that God has provided her with a great gift of a son. But what we actually find in the words that are actually used by Eve are, in fact, actually not so much an acknowledgement to God that he has provided a child to her and the blessings that would have. But we are informed that she only said this with regard to Cain, and only because he was her firstborn son. And we find that actually Eve isn't really acknowledging that God has provided this gift to her. That word that was used and translated here as acquired is not one of a gift from God. Indeed, we recognize, don't we, that God gives us the gift of children. And indeed, we are greatly privileged The world normally talks about children being responsible to their parents. The Bible talks about both parents and children being responsible to God. And we are provided our children as a gift, aren't we? That we are looking after by that responsibility that God has provided to us, to nurture and to bring these children up. But this is not what Eve is referring to. Indeed, Eve, in the word she used, is referring to an acquirement, something that she has obtained, something that is bought, as if she had bought it from God. Indeed, we think about the fall that had only happened a few verses in advance of this, and we think about the fact that the judgment that was upon Eve was that God said that Adam would rule over her. And we find in a short time period that actually what is happening here is that Eve is happy that she has a male child, that she might be able to rule over them. This is unfortunately the continuation of that battle that would continue for the rest of time. And the reality is that she gives far more credence to Cain's birth than she should have done. And in the acknowledgements that we have about the fact that she had another son, Abel, in the name that she has provided him with, she dismisses him out of hand. She has a very specific, overwhelming priority on Cain. And that balance is not an appropriate one. And indeed, we find that, unfortunately, that leads to further problems. Indeed, we all know what happens if we favour one child within a family over others. There are many consequences that come about. And unfortunately, this is one of those situations. And we find in this that by the end of verse 2, not only have they been born, but they have grown up and they have become adults. And they are probably in their 30s. And we know from further verses on that Cain is married. We're not told about Abel. We don't know whether he was married or not. There's no reference to that. But one assumes, because of that lack of reference, that probably he wasn't. But we know Cain was married. And it doesn't take long to realize that Cain, the only person that Cain could be married to, is one of his sisters. So the lack of reference to the fact that he has sisters at this time isn't an important one. They are there. They are in existence. And so, as men, they have been given specific roles. Indeed, they seem to have specific capabilities, skills, aspects that God has actually enabled them in an amazing way to do a particular task. And we read in here that Abel was the one who looked after small cattle. Indeed, we have in our Bibles often referred to this word translated as sheep, but the original word is small cattle. Indeed, it may well have been sheep. I'm not saying that it wasn't, but it's important that we don't always use English words to make us understand things. We have a tendency of putting things into a modern context, don't we? And the reality is, at this time, Adam and Eve and their children live in a perfect world, or a non-perfect world, that had been previously created perfect, been damaged by sin, but actually there had the wonders of all of God's creation. Indeed, there were dinosaurs, there were many of the animals that we recognize today there at that time. And the land space was vast, and you can imagine they could travel, they could have wandered around and spent quite a bit of time away from one another or in one another's company very, very easily, and enjoyed actually the creation that God had made. But we need to remember, it's not in the context that we have today. So these animals that Abel is looking after, he's not looking after them for food. Okay? He is looking after them probably because maybe it is sheep. Maybe it was because of the wool that they would be able to make clothing from the fur, as it were, of those animals, or the wool from those animals. And indeed, that would be obviously a benefit. But in many respects, maybe it was considered to be a little bit of a luxury, maybe, within the family. And we are told that Cain grew crops. Indeed, he was a tiller of the ground. That's a phrase that is used, is that he was a slave to the ground. So effectively, he was the one who spent many hours in the field, preparing the field, getting rid of the weeds that now grew, and to actually lay down that seed to then be able to bring that crop up for its life cycles, eventually harvest from that, whether that was vegetables or wheat or other types of food that we may not recognize today. But that was his responsibility. And Cain was, and Abel were very capable. And they did that to a great ability. Indeed, Cain was quite able to achieve wondrous crops that he was able to grow with his own hands. Now, somewhere along the line, we discover in this that Cain and Abel have a differing way of looking at the world and a differing way of looking at their service to God. And we find in verse 3 that Cain brings an offering of the fruit of the ground. The actual wording in the original actually refers to it as being a meal offering. It was an offering of a meal, something that Cain had prepared. He'd grown with his own hands, and he made the food, and he was presenting that food to God. But in the context of this, the wording that we are provided with, we discover that it is an offering. It isn't the first fruits of what he has grown. It isn't the best of what he has produced. It is an offering. Indeed, Cain's heart was not what it should be. Cain saw his own ability, and he thought what he did was wondrous. He thought much more of himself than he should have done. Indeed, when he was thinking about what he was going to bring before God, he didn't think that actually it should be the best. He didn't think it should be the first of what he's produced, because God's actually provided it to him. But rather, Cain has seen it only fit to give something of what he has grown. And indeed, in many respects, we can look upon this, can't we, as really the first time that a human being is trying to reduce God to our own understanding, into our own needs. Indeed, in many respects, more of an idolatry situation. Whereas if God needed a meal from Cain, God did not require anything from Cain in order exist. And yet Cain seems to feel that it is appropriate for him to bring a meal to God. And it is that attitude that Cain had which was at fault. Indeed, we look on in verse 4 and we find that Abel was in contrast doing things in a different way. We are told that Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and their fat. That word "their fat" is referring to the best of that flock. So Abel, in contrast to his brother, comes here presenting the very firstborn, the first lambing of those animals that he is looking after. And he doesn't just pick one of those. He works out which one is the best. Indeed, he could think about maybe thinking, well, I'll keep the best because then that will allow me to be able to breed more animals that are better, fitter, and so forth. But no, he takes this opportunity to give back to God the very best of what God has given to him. And indeed, we're shown here that Abel wanted to be right before God. That was his intention. He wanted to be right before God. And he looked at what he had available to him and thought, what can I present? What can I present to God, the one true God, who doesn't need anything from me at all? What do I give to him? And I am sure that Abel thought about all the things that his father Adam and his mother Eve had actually told him about what had happened previously. And indeed, he would have reflected on the fact that God had sacrificed an animal, shed its blood, so that they would be forgiven for their sins, that indeed that sin might be covered up. And he felt that that was the appropriate thing to do. There was no instructions, there was no aspect of where God had laid out and said, this is what I expect from you. But rather he looks at that example that he sees that God has placed for him. And he goes and does likewise. So he takes that animal and he slays that animal as an offering to God. God responded in two different ways in what we are told here. And we find that we have the word respected. The Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. Unfortunately, the English language is a little bit restrictive, shall we say, on the words that we can use. But maybe, actually, the better translation for the word in the original would be that God gave Abel attention. So God gave attention to Abel, and he didn't give attention to Cain. There was Abel thinking about what he could do for the service of God, and the Lord gives him attention. And Cain, thinking only of himself, really, does not receive that attention from God. Indeed, we know children love attention, don't they? We all love attention. I mean, even as adults, we love attention. We want to have what we do acknowledged and to be seen to be good. We want people to say, that was a really great job that you've done there. And they want that attention, don't they? They want that praise from someone. And here we find that Abel has that attention. We don't know what that would have looked like. We know that in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve had walked with God in the garden. And we know that that was no longer available to them. But we acknowledge from what is actually shared in chapter 4 that God spoke with and gave attention to his people. And so, although we don't know exactly what that was, we know that that attention was given to Abel, and it wasn't given to Cain. How do we think about our service for God? How do we think about what we do? When we go to work, when we go to school, even if we're unemployed, the things that we do day by day. Maybe people are retired. What you do during your day. Is it about what you are achieving? Or do you do things for the glory of God? Do you do the very best for him? That is the question that we should all be asking ourselves this evening. What do we do? Are we Abel or are we Cain? Do we really give to God the first fruits of what we produce? Is that the first thing we do each month when maybe we get our salary? Does our tithe, is that the first part of the money? Or do we tithe or give offerings of whatever is left at the end of the month? How do we approach what we do for God? When we're thinking about doing things at work, And we're thinking, oh, we want to make that achievement. We want to maybe be promoted at work because we know there's higher salary. There's good things that come from higher salaries. We can afford life a bit more easily, can't we? But do we think, actually, I want to get that promotion, not because it says something about me, but because of what it says for the person I'm actually working for? Do I work for God or do I work for man? Do I give the very best of myself to God? Whether we have money, whether we are poor, we all have the opportunity of giving the first of our time or the bit that's left over at the end of the working day. What do we do before God? What is our offering to Him each day? Indeed, we find here that Cain was very angry and his countenance fell. Indeed, we can look at that word countenance. It's not words that we often use today. It's probably best a good word to use that is similar to that, that we use in everyday language, is our attitude. Yeah, Cain's anger and his attitude fell. We know the situation, don't we? If any of us have told a teenager off at any point in time, we know exactly what is described here. Whenever we tell our teenagers off, they become angry. How dare we tell them off? They have not done anything wrong in their eyes. And their attitude falls apart, doesn't it? They mope around the house, they start slamming the doors, all those sort of things take place. We know exactly what happens when somebody is upset. Cain here is angry and he's upset and he's storming around and he's making everybody know that he's not happy about the situation. And indeed, God turns to Cain and says, "Why are you angry? Why are you angry, Cain? And why has your attitude got so bad?" I know I've asked my children that many, many times. It's almost a regular situation. Why are you so angry at being told off? Why is your attitude so bad? And we know really what the answer is behind that. And God knows what the answer is behind that. And God says to him, "If you do well, will you not be accepted? You're so angry. You feel so hard done by. But what actually has happened? Surely, if you do like Abel does, and you do what you're supposed to do, surely you're going to be accepted. Surely, God is going to provide that attention to you. Because you have done what you have done to His honor and His glory. Surely He is going to accept you. And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door." Indeed, we have a picture here, don't we? Almost an animal lying at the doorway, seeking our affection. We can think of many animals, I'm sure, but what came to my mind particularly was a dog. Often, you know, we will find that a dog, if anyone owns a dog, we often find they lie at the doorway, don't they? They're there making sure that we don't leave without giving them attention. They want affection from us. They want us to pat them. They want us to feed them. They want us to do wonderful things for them. And they will be quite happy if we spend our entire time looking after just them. And it's really that picture here, that sin is like that animal that wishes to gain our affection, lying at the doorway, waiting for us to give it more time and more energy. Indeed, we have here an explanation of what sin is for us. We had an original explanation of sin that Adam and Eve had that was a template for all sin. But they were perfect, weren't they, to start with? And then they disobeyed. Here we have Cain, born into sin, in the same way as we are. We're all born into sin. We're all sinners from the moment we are born. And we can understand, can't we, more of Cain's experience because we have a similar situation. And we all know that we do things wrong. And God brings this to his attention and he says, look, it's not some major thing that you've done wrong. It's not that you've gone, in many respects, majorly out of your way to be disobedient. But you are disobedient. You're putting yourself first. You're not honoring God. And indeed, we have an option. We have a choice. We can either feed that sin, or we can learn to control it. And God turns to him and says, its desire is for you. Sin's desire is for you. But you should rule over it. Indeed, that is the choice we all have. Whatever sin there is in our lives, we have a simple choice. We can either feed that sin. We can give it all our time and our affection. Or we can turn to God. And we can gain control of that sin. And God says to Cain, control your sin. Control it. Do what is right. Turn away from what you've done. Do what is right. And you will be accepted. Seems quite a simple thing to do, doesn't it? Nothing major here that Cain's been asked to do. In many respects, we noticed that, didn't we, with Adam and Eve. It's very simple. One tree that you don't eat the fruit from. Giving you hundreds of thousands of trees, surely that's the simplest task I could give you. And yet Adam and Eve failed. This, again, is a very simple task. All Cain has to do is acknowledge what he's done wrong and put it right. It's a simple thing. And yet, what happens? What does Cain actually do? What we find is in verse 8. Now Cain talked with Abel his brother, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. That was the anger that Cain had in his life. Cain fed his sin. He left that situation and he just thought about it and he thought about it. And he thought about it. And all that he spent his time thinking about was how hard done by he was and how much he hated his brother. It was a simple task, and yet he chose to feed the sin. Indeed, we find that he has this overwhelming aspect. He talks with his brother Abel. We don't even know what he spoke about. We don't know what Abel said to him. Sometimes it can be infuriating, can't it? We want to know a little bit more than the Bible tells us. But I'm sure Abel was probably telling him the same things that God had. That he wasn't doing anything special. That he wasn't trying to be better than Cain. All he was trying to do was to honor God. And yet Cain had a fit of rage. He has the ultimate tantrum, doesn't he? And in a fit of rage, he kills his brother. He destroys him. And indeed, we see here, don't we, that Cain is full of jealousy. He is so jealous of his brother because he got attention from God. But Cain himself had not. Cain here is so full of his self-importance, isn't he? He seems to think that without doing anything for God, that God somehow should just honour him. His existence in life is so important that God should be giving him time and attention. Indeed, we find that Cain buries his brother, probably in the field that he was working in normally, and he gets rid of the evidence. We know that one from any crime, don't we? We watch crime programs all the time on TV these days, And what we see is, as soon as someone's done something, when they've murdered somebody, they know exactly what they have done. And they are ashamed, and they want to hide it. And Cain is no different. He was here, the first murder, and the first thing he does is he hides the evidence. He gets rid of it. And the Lord comes to Cain, and he says, "Where is Abel, your brother?" Now, God knows exactly what has happened. But he gives here opportunity to Cain to own up to what he has done and to deal with it in a proper way. But what does Cain actually say in response? "I don't know. Am I my brother's keeper?" Well, if we look at that in a little bit more detail, we actually realize that actually, thinking back to our teenagers again, this is a very common response that we get from our teenagers when we've asked, "What have you done wrong? What have you done?" And they declare that they don't know. Of course they know. And yet they declare that they don't know. But in the words that Cain uses here is not only that he doesn't know, it's more of a, "I can't possibly know. How could I possibly know?" response. Or even a lack of concern. "I don't care where Abel is." That's the response he is giving to God. "I don't care where Abel is." And then he says, "Am I brother's keeper?" What he's saying there is, maybe translated in a slightly different way that would be helpful, is, "Am I my brother's only protector?" Now, this isn't a question. Just like his parents, Cain, first response that he does is he blames God. He turns around in this sentence, in this question, he effectively says, "Why did you not protect Abel from me? Why didn't you protect Abel from me? Surely you are the one who should be protecting Abel, not me." What a response to God. And God turns, doesn't he, and says, "What have you done? What have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." Indeed, God knew exactly what had happened. He knew that Cain had buried Abel. He knew before he'd even asked the questions. And yet Cain's responses are so appalling, aren't they? Cain completely dismisses his responsibility. And he blames God. And we find in the next few verses that God provides a sentence to Cain. He gives him a consequence for his actions. And we find in this that Cain, despite all his capability, would, when he grows crops, find that those crops just don't grow in the way they used to. Indeed, we actually have an example in the modern era. It was a number of years ago missionaries went over to an area of South America, or maybe Central America, and they went to this Inuit camp, and effectively that they were ministering to these people. Now, these people had grown vegetables all the time. They'd not been out of this area. They knew the land very well. And so they grew their crops there. And when the ministry came to them, and they found out about Jesus and what he had done for them, they were converted. The whole village were converted through the ministry. They found that next year that all the vegetables that they had always grown were three times larger than they had grown previously. The ground provided for them in a way that it had never done before. What is described here for us in this passage is the consequence for Cain is that the ground would no longer provide that strength for him. it was going to be even harder to grow crops than it had already been. If the punishment wasn't bad enough, that they were going to have to deal with the weeds, the thistles, the thorns, that they'd have to grow these plants themselves. They wouldn't just grow for them and provide the fruit. They would have to do the work themselves. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, Cain's punishment is that the ground would be even harsher towards them. And indeed, we find that Cain, again, his response is a problem. Actually, before I come to that, I accidentally skipped something. We find here that God turns to him and says that you're going to be a fugitive and a vagabond on the earth. Indeed, the words that are actually provided actually imply that you're going to shake and tremble. You're going to be a wanderer. You're going to grieve. And you're going to flutter from place to place. Your life is not going to be what it has been. You are never going, you're always going to be looking over your shoulder. Effectively. You know what you have done. You are going to grieve for your brother for the rest of your life. And you are going to fear with all trembling. This was an experience Cain had never had in his life before. And when provided with that, Cain, either in realization or fear maybe, overstates the punishment, doesn't he? He seems to initially repeat back to God what God has said. As if he is acknowledging that. And he's saying, yes, I acknowledge what I have done. I accept that punishment. And I understand it. But the reality is far from it. Cain is not turning around to God and saying, I accept that. Cain is turning around and saying to God, you are being too harsh to me. You are being too harsh to me. I don't deserve to be treated this way. How can he say this? And yet we find, don't we, that that is our response before we are converted. We turn around to God and we say, I don't deserve this. And God says, yes, you do. You deserve that consequence. And he has every right to fulfill that judgment. And indeed, here we find that Cain, the extent to which he says that this is unfair, says, and anyone who finds me will kill me. Now, bearing in mind that the world population at this time includes Adam, Eve, a couple of sisters, and that's it. Yeah. So, who is going to come after Cain? Who is he so terrified of that is going to revenge? Cain declares his fear purely to turn to God and say, you're being too harsh to me. You're punishing me far too greatly. So what does God do? He says, okay. And he places a mark upon Cain. This mark is unique to Cain. And we don't know what the mark is. Maybe it was a tattoo. Who knows? We don't know what this mark was. But somehow God put a mark, maybe a scar, who knows, on Cain. And it was unique to Cain. And it said to Adam and Eve and his couple of sisters, you are to leave him alone. He is to be banished. You are not to have anything to do with him. And you are not to seek vengeance on him. Because I will create the vengeance. I will bring that upon you far greater. Indeed, we find that in those verses after we have read, we find that the family of Cain departs. Cain and his wife leave, and they create a city. And that city develops, it populates, it gets quite powerful. And in many respects, people think, oh, God allows these bad people to get away with it. But actually, they were facing God's judgment. And we find that it only takes another five generations. So that's Cain's great-great-great-grandson before we see the second murder. And what we find about that second murder is that Lamech actually is even more arrogant than Cain. He thinks he's even more privileged than Cain. And he thinks he has the right to take somebody's life. Five generations from Cain. And there is absolutely no regard at all for God. Indeed, you'll read in that section that indeed he turns round and he says, if anyone avenges, I will respond not sevenfold as God said, I'll respond 70-fold. His arrogance and his dismissal of God has reached the point where he thinks he is greater than God. Five generations from Cain. Are we surprised when we look at the number of generations since then that the world is as it is today? Indeed, I would actually turn around and say, I'm actually more surprised that actually we don't have many, many more murders. That's the reality. If sin left to its own devices destroys and makes men and women behave in terrible ways, and actually it should be more of a surprise to us that things aren't actually a lot worse than they actually are. If mankind was left to his own devices, we'd be in a much more terrible place than we are. So the reality is, actually, God has continued working. God has continued working in all of these situations, and he's prevented those things from happening. We find in those verses as well, which is a side thing, but I think it's always helpful to put things into context. People think, oh, well, how does this relate to what the scientists say? Well, we find that Lamech's three sons, Jabal, he basically built tents, and he took livestock, and he became a nomad. We then find that Jabal became a musician. He actually made harps, and he made flutes, and he made music. And Zillah, his third son, was a craftsman in bronze and iron. So the Bible teaches us, five generations after Cain, we have the Bronze Age and we have the Iron Age. Very, very, very different to the explanation the scientists give us today. The Bible is clear, and the evidence matches what the Bible teaches us. What they are surprised about when they do their findings around the globe is how there's so few evidences of a lack of bronze and iron in the area of human life that they would expect it to be. It's always seemingly been there, except for right at the very beginning. And yet we are taught in our books that it comes much later. We're told in our books that man is primitive. He has no real understanding of what he's doing. But the Bible teaches us mankind knew exactly what he was doing. Mankind knew, and he was very skilled. It isn't ignorance that causes Cain his problems. It is his overwhelming self-belief in his own self-worthiness. He thinks he is better than God. Indeed, we think through, and we think about Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 4, where we read the words, by faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gifts, and through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. So there in Hebrews, the writer acknowledges Abel, shows what Abel did in the understanding of faith. Indeed, we find when we're looking at the passage in Genesis chapter 5 that after these things had taken place, Adam and Eve had another son, Seth. And they had many sons and daughters. But we know that through Seth was the line that God was going to work. Indeed, it was Eve who thought the firstborn son was the significant one. She thought that this was her opportunity to rule over man. She thought that the firstborn was the one that God was going to use. But that's not the workings of God. Many, many people turn around and say, when they look through Genesis, and they say, oh, God always puts through in the Bible that it's always the firstborn son that is the most important. Dismisses women, dismisses the other sons, it's always the firstborn. That's a complete wrong view of Scripture. The reality is here, right from this outset, God chose to use the younger son. And we can go throughout the whole of Scripture and we can show that actually God each time uses the younger son. God used Noah's younger son, Shem, to be the line through which Abraham, the youngest son, would become Abraham. His youngest son, Isaac. And then we go on to the youngest son, Jacob, as the line by which God was calling his people. God has never chosen the firstborn son. God has worked through from the last, the youngest son. We even know from David, King David was the youngest son. The way God works is not the way mankind thinks. And right here, from the outset of Scripture, God works in a very different way to what people, mankind, think he should. Indeed, as we come now to a conclusion on this, we acknowledge, don't we, in what we've read here, that what we can share with others, what we can remind ourselves of, is sin courts us. And it grows in our lives if it's left unchecked. Sin destroys. Sin corrupts, absolutely. And we can all find ourselves in the same position as Cain. Yes, okay, many of us may not murder people. But I wonder how many have killed people in their hearts. Indeed, sin has a judgment. Sin has a consequence. And what we can see is share with other people that is very clear from this passage is that God honours those who seek to please him. You see, the message is not that God is making things really difficult for you, that you've got to do the most complicated thing. You can go to other religions and you can find out that within Buddhism you can have to go up to the tallest mountain that you can locate. You can put yourself in a yoga position that is the most complicated one that your body can physically cope with. You're going to balance yourself on the edge of that cliff and you're going to hope that you don't die. And if you don't die, then maybe you'll be right before God. None of that is what Christianity teaches. Christianity, right from the outset, where God is showing what is required of us, it is not what we do that matters. It is what we are intending to achieve. Do we do it for the glory of God? Do we do the things we do for his glory? Do we do the things we do because we want to give him the best of our lives? Do we do the things for that reason? Or do we do things because Pastor told us to? We're worried about what somebody else might say. You see, I've often said, I don't care whether you arrive on time or late for me. What I hope and pray is that you want to give the best of you to God. It is not my rules. It is not, and we can't criticize on that basis, can we? There's many, many reasons why any of us could arrive late. And it'd be very easy, wouldn't it, to turn around and think, oh, that person arrived late, how terrible. We don't know what's just happened. But they do. And each one of us, when we are thinking about what we do, whether we're working in the church, whether we're preparing for what we're going to do on Sunday, whether we're thinking about what we're doing on a Saturday night, whether we're thinking about Monday morning going to school or work, do we want to give the very best of ourselves to God? Do we work for Him? That is what fundamentally matters. Indeed, God establishes His work of grace, doesn't He? Right here at the outset, He's offering Cain that grace. But Cain refuses it out of choice, and he kills his brother. Indeed, let us all consider upon this, that indeed we might not be like Cain, but that we might indeed acknowledge, like Abel, that our time, our money, the gifts that God has given us, are what we should be using for Him. If I can encourage you to turn to the last hymn book, the last hymn from your hymn book, which is hymn number... got myself out of order. 700.